Well, it is election time, isn't it? And the candidates are out in force trying to canvass for our vote. The media are analysing everything from someone's body language to their choice of tie. But I suspect that most of us are pretty fatigued already with electioneering. In fact, I think across the world, people are pretty fed up with politicians. They see politicians as two-faced, as to saying whatever they need to say to win votes, launching new initiatives and making no difference. But I think what we often don't do is to pause to reflect on whether the leadership we have reflects the people that we are. You know, have we been given the leadership that we deserve as a nation? And I think that's kind of the territory we're in as we come into John chapter 7. So at one level, as you read through John 7, what you see is that Jesus just has extraordinary integrity. Where perhaps the leaders of his day, the leaders of our day, lack integrity, Jesus has it by the bagload. And yet at the same time, we see the crowd continue to reject Jesus. And I think what he shows us is that their rejection of him says more about them than it does about him. Or to put it another way, it takes a person of integrity to follow a man of integrity. So you can see there's a lot of debate going on here about who Jesus is. You can see it, I know, in verse 12. There was much muttering about him among the people. Some said he's a good man. Others said, no, he's leading people astray. And what Jesus does is he takes that debate about himself and turns it back on the people and says, actually, whether you accept me or reject me says quite a lot about you. So what I want to do is just go through the passage and see three ways in which we see Jesus' integrity and then three ways in which that invites us to respond to him. And in the first place we see his integrity is that he has the integrity to challenge the world around him. So if you cast your mind back a couple of weeks when we were in chapter 6, we saw Jesus in chapter 6 increasingly opposed. The crowds began to desert him. He was just left with his disciples. And by the time we get to the beginning of chapter 7, verse 1, we're told, after this, Jesus went about in Galilee. He would not go about in Judea because the Jews were seeking to kill him. So he has had a PR disaster. And his brothers decide to step in. They see Jesus lagging behind in the polls and say, we've got to do something. So verse 3, his brothers said to Jesus, leave here and go to Judea that your disciples also may see the works you're doing. For no one works in secret if he seeks to be known openly. If you do these things, show yourself to the world. Get out there. You've got a good show. Go and give it the hard sell. That's what they're saying. Can't just stick a leaflet in the library and hope that people will come to see you. You need a marketing department. Look, Jerusalem, that's where all the business is. Not only that, but it's the Feast of Booths. That's one of three festivals where Jewish men had to go to Jerusalem. So Jerusalem's going to be heaving. That's where it's happening. Get up there and let them see what you've got. Show your stuff to the world. And I guess if you go around the offices here, every office has a marketing department, right? Even hospitals have marketing departments. That's extraordinary. Last time I was in a marketing department, my son had got his fingers stuck in the spokes of his bike. He was fine. I did not need a marketing salesman to tell me to go to the hospital. But everyone has marketing people. And Jesus' brothers are saying to him, sort your marketing out. So they believe that he can do signs and miracles. But John tells us that they don't believe in Jesus because actually they've not yet worked out where those signs point. And this is the issue. So what we saw back in chapter 6. In chapter 6, we saw Jesus do signs. He fed 5,000 people and they loved it. But by the end of the chapter, they're all deserting him because the signs are not an end in itself. They're not stunts. They point somewhere. They point to Jesus' teaching. And that is where the issue comes. So I think there are three sort of key verses in this section. And the first of those is in verse 7, where Jesus says to his disciples, "The world cannot hate you, but it hates me because I testify about it that its works are evil." Now, evil is a pretty strong word, isn't it, to describe the works of the world? But it's what we see. People abusing power, people abusing people. And as Jesus steps into this world, he has the integrity to challenge it. He's not afraid to testify of the world that its works are evil. In John's gospel, the world always refers to the world in rebellion against Jesus. And so Jesus is saying to his brothers, you're of the world, the world's happy with you. I'm not. I have the integrity to challenge the world. I testify that its works are evil and so it hates me. Again, hate is a pretty strong word. But Jesus would be proved to be right. They would crucify him. And so the brothers' plan, go to Jerusalem, do the miracles, it'll be great. It's not going to work because it's not about the signs. And actually, when Jesus does go, he doesn't perform signs. So you can see a contrast here. Jesus' brothers, they're of the world. They're looking for worldly, impressive miracles. Jesus himself confronts the world. He's got the integrity to challenge. Back in chapter 3, we saw this idea that if people's deeds are evil, they don't want to step into Jesus' light. Because as you step into the light, we can see all the stains. And that's kind of the idea we have here. People don't want to have their wrongdoing challenged. And so they hate Jesus. My 7-year-old daughter was playing the piano the other day, doing her piano practice. And she was getting the rhythm wrong. And I tried to correct her and said, look, you're getting this all wrong. And she didn't want to know. She said, I don't want to know, Daddy. I'm getting it right. And she just kept playing it wrong. Eventually, she put her fingers in her ears and was literally going, no, I can't hear you. That's what we do when we are criticized. We don't want to hear it. It's what the world around us do. It's what all of us do. You know that moment when your boss calls you into a quiet meeting room and says, look, can we have a chat about that presentation you did the other day? And your heart sinks because you're getting ready for the criticism that's coming. We don't like criticism. It stings. And so far easier to follow a God who won't give criticism, who will just affirm us all the time. But that's not Jesus. He's got the integrity to challenge us. So that means that to come to Jesus requires humility. He'll challenge not just the evil of humanity around me that offends me, but he'll challenge the evil in my own heart. He won't just forgive my sins of the past that I'm ashamed of. He'll also challenge my wrongdoing today and insist that I battle my sin in his strength. We want a God who'll just affirm us with a kind word, who'll sort things out for us with a miracle. But Jesus has the integrity to challenge. And it takes a person of integrity to follow a person of integrity. I think the thing is, logically, we all know this, right? Logically, we know that being open to criticism is the best way to live. And yet, for all that we know that in our minds, it's hard to respond to that like that in our hearts. How is it that we will come to accept criticism from Jesus? Well, I think it's as we deepen in our respect for him. Actually, as we look at him here, that he has the integrity to call things as they are, to challenge wrongdoing, to not mince his words, to confront evil, even when it is deeply costly to him. Well, what a breath of fresh air compared to so many leaders of our generation. Here is someone that is worth following. Here is someone that is worth listening to, even when it is uncomfortable. So he has a purity of motive. So Jesus has an integrity to challenge. And secondly, he has an integrity of motive. So John tells us, verse 14, about the middle of the feast, Jesus went up into the temple and began teaching. The Jews therefore marveled, saying, how is it that this man has learning when he has never studied? And the focus now shifts onto Jesus' authority to teach. By the way, it's worth saying, initially he said he wasn't going to go to the feast, and then he decides he is. I think it must be because God initially said, don't go now, and then said, right, now is the time to go. The end of the chapter, we'll see him on the last day of the feast standing up and making a great big declaration. I guess if he'd gone too early, maybe the opposition would have built and he wouldn't have been able to be there on the last day of the feast. But clearly something has changed, that now is the right moment for him to go up. Well, the way teaching used to work in the rabbinical schools was that the rabbis would always quote other people. You know, Rabbi Joseph says that, Rabbi Bob says this, and they'd compare it. But when Jesus speaks, he doesn't quote other people. So he seems to speak on his own authority, and they wonder at, they marvel. Maybe actually they're slightly offended. Who does this guy think he is? He hasn't been a rabbi school, he doesn't quote anybody. And so Jesus says, verse 16, my teaching is not mine, but his who sent me. He's not quoting other rabbis, but he's not speaking off the top of his head either. He's speaking with God's authority. And I think the second key verse in this passage is verse 17. If anyone's will is to do God's will, he will know whether the teaching is from God or whether I'm speaking on my own authority. In other words, you're debating about who I am, but the answer actually lies in your own heart. If your desire is to please God, to serve him, to seek him, then you'll be able to discern that my authority to teach comes from God. If you're seeking God's truth, you'll know it when you find it. You know those kind of adverts you get on television for supermarket coffee or something like that? You know, when our man from Sainsbury's goes looking for the coffee beans, he looks for the best beans in the world. And you have all these shots of some bloke in a crumpled suit going around all the far-flung places of the world. And then he finds the bean and he tastes it. And, ah, this is it. He's found it. Well, the sense here is that if we have a taste for God's teaching, then when we find Jesus, we'll know that we're tasting the teaching that comes from God. There's a moral dimension to understanding. The person who's not seeking God will not think of Jesus as anybody special when they find him. A bit like the person who doesn't really care about coffee won't be that impressed with the coffee bean. They don't have a taste for it. We can't examine Jesus without submitting to him. We can't examine the Christian faith without. Often we see that, don't we? We hear atheists critiquing Christianity, and it becomes very clear they don't really understand it. It's like listening to someone who's teetotal give tasting descriptions for a bottle of wine. It just doesn't work. Now, we might say, isn't this all slightly circular? What you're saying is you won't believe unless you believe. But I think the point has to do with our motives. Our motives and Jesus. Are we seeking God's teaching? Because if that is our motive, then when we come to Jesus, we'll realize that we found it. And the same is true of Jesus' motives. Verse 18, the one who speaks on his own authority seeks his own glory. But the one who seeks the glory of him who sent him is true, and in him there is no falsehood. So if I speak my own ideas and people approve of them, then I feel good. I get the glory. But if I speak someone else's ideas and people approve, they get the glory. And that's what Jesus is saying. I'm not speaking on my own authority, seeking my own glory. I'm speaking for God and his glory. So you can see Jesus' integrity of motive. Again, there's a contrast. The crowd want to talk about religious things to make themselves feel clever. Jesus is speaking of the things of God for God's glory. So to seek God impacts my motives. It's to set aside my own glory and seek God's glory. That is what Jesus is doing. Now, that is not to say that when I seek God's glory, I'm not living the best way, that I'm not finding fulfillment, that I'm not living in a way that is truly human. But it is to say that if God is on the throne, I'm not. The glory goes to him. At church, we have a screen that we put the words of the songs on, and we have one of those projectors of the big light that shines up onto the screen. And sometimes on a Sunday morning when I'm getting ready, I accidentally step in front of the screen, and the light now is shining onto me. You can see the words of the songs. Because when I step out of the way, now the light shines onto the screen. Well, Jesus here is saying, look, it's not about me. I'm not one of these religious charlatans who just wants everyone to glorify me. I want to step out of the way that the light, the glory, would fall fully on Jesus, on God the Father. That is what Jesus is doing, and that's what he calls us to do. He has an integrity of motive, and it takes a person of integrity to follow a person of integrity. Often we meet people who love to talk about religion. Maybe they're not a believer, but they like to show that they've got an understanding of history, of culture. Maybe they're a Christian who likes to use church for a sense of being respectable, or being wise, or even being needed. And what Jesus is cutting through to here is our motives. Are we seeking God to know him, to worship him? Or are we using God to make ourselves look good? We'll hit this if we try and share our faith. People's motives will be mixed. It's very tempting to say to someone, look, come to Jesus because he'll make you feel fulfilled. Well, that is true. But actually, we need to point them to God's glory, because it's as they seek God's glory that Jesus will begin to make sense to them. I guess this is challenging because we all know that we have mixed motives ourselves. As we seek after God, what do we do when we find our heart is divided? Well, we repent, and then we look afresh to Jesus. What a wonderful integrity. If ever there was anyone who could have sought their own glory and taken the limelight, it was him. And yet here he is, putting it onto Jesus. What a breath of fresh air and integrity of motive. But I'm conscious that we need to push a little bit deeper, because the people of Jesus today would have said, well, I am seeking God because I'm keeping the law of Moses. And before they have a chance to say that, Jesus says, verse 19, has not Moses given you the law, and yet none of you keeps the law? And what we now push on to is his integrity of action. So what he does is he refers back to the healing of the lame man in chapter 5, when he healed on the Sabbath, and they were scandalized because he told the man to carry his mat, and it looked like he was working on the Sabbath, and they had all these rules about what you could and couldn't do on the Sabbath. And what Jesus says is, look, if a baby is born and 8 days later is the Sabbath, you still circumcise the baby. It's a way of making it whole. Well, isn't it the same with healing someone on the Sabbath? So you can see the logic goes to verse 21. I did one work, that's the healing on the Sabbath, and you marvel at it. Marvel at it in the sense of being scandalized. How could he do this? Verse 22, Moses gave you circumcision, not that it's from Moses, but the fathers, and you circumcise a man on the Sabbath. If on the Sabbath a man receives circumcision, so the law of Moses may not be broken, are you angry with me because on the Sabbath I made a man's whole body well? It's okay to circumcise on the Sabbath to make someone whole in that sense. So it's okay to heal on the Sabbath. And the key then comes in verse 24, the third key verse. Don't judge by appearances, but judge with right judgment. So it looked like Jesus was working when he healed on the Sabbath, because these people are just so caught up in their rules rather than their heart. They're living by the letter of the law rather than the spirit of the law. And he says, look, here's the contrast. You're interested in appearances. I'm interested in actually healing. There's an integrity of action. There was all this stuff in the papers on Monday about the Remembrance Day parade, and apparently Boris put the wreath down upside down, and apparently Jeremy Corbyn didn't quite bow low enough. It's kind of missing the point, isn't it? We're there to remember the dead rather than all this. Did he get that right? And that's what the people of Jesus' day are doing. They're missing the point. At our church, we used to have a big organ, pipe organ. It looked magnificent, but the engine didn't work as it could make any noise. It looked great, but there was no engine to make it work. Well, so it is with the religion of these people. They're interested in appearances, but there's no substance to it. It doesn't work. Whereas Jesus has an integrity of action. We live in a society, I think, that is obsessed with appearances. Humanism chases after the goodness of humanity, respect, tolerance, inclusion, love. But there's no engine to pump it. We can't live this out. And what happens? At some point, someone fails, they crack a crass joke, or they make a stupid comment, and we all jump on the bandwagon and point the finger and say, that person broke the rules. There's no engine. Now, respect and tolerance and inclusion and love, they're good things. The law of Moses was a good thing. But the way to fulfill it, according to Jesus, is not just with rules and appearances. Oh, I stuck the anti-bullying poster on the notice board, we're done here. What we need is a change of heart. And Jesus comes, he heals the lame man, and he heals us. When he died on the cross, he took the penalty for all of our sin and promises to lead us, transformed into God's kingdom to come. A deep forgiveness and a deep change. And the question he's asking us is, will we settle for just the appearance of a good life, or thirst for the reality, the engine that Jesus brings? Will we settle for respectability, for going to a church that seems to be working okay on the surface, for faith that seems to tick the box, for kids that aren't at least scandalous in their behavior? Or will we have a passion to grow and to change and to witness to Jesus? Jesus has an integrity of action. And it is impressive. So that's John chapter 7, the first bit. And I think what we see here is Jesus' integrity. His integrity to challenge, his integrity of motive, and his integrity of action. And yet for all that, he is opposed, because it takes a person of integrity to follow a person of integrity. And I think the question we're left with is, will we seek Jesus with humility to be challenged, seeking God's glory and setting aside appearances, Or will we be too proud and too caught up in ourselves and our appearances to listen to him?